Welcome to the second episode of CM Podcasts, Conversations in Clinical, Medical and Health Nutrition, hosted by me, Jodie.
And me, Faye. This episode links to the CM article, Enteral Tube Feeding in the Community, which ran in our June issue. And we're delighted that we're joined by Michelle Barry, author of the article, who will be focusing on enteral tube feeding in patients with a progressive neurological condition.
Michelle is a highly skilled specialist home enteral feed dietitian in the Gloucestershire community, a role she has been in for nearly 10 years. She qualified as a dietitian in South Africa, gaining extensive clinical experience across surgical, medical and paediatric wards, as well as outpatient clinics. Michelle relocated to the UK in 2015. Michelle is also an active contributor to the field of dietetics. She has contributed many articles to CM Magazine and was awarded CM Writer of the Year in 2024. Reflecting her commitment to advancing dietetic knowledge and practice, Michelle also presented a webinar on the subject of blended diets in enteral feeding at the 2024 third annual event for the Blended Diet Network in December. We would like to thank Nutritia Homewood for sponsoring the production of this podcast to enable CM readers to listen to this free of charge. Now, before we start, we would just like to thank Michelle for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Jodie and Faye. It's very, very exciting to be here.
So, Michelle, when deciding on the route of feed for those with neurological conditions such as Parkinson's, motor neuron disease and dementia, what would you say are the main considerations?
Okay, well, let's start with a bit of a definition of enteral feeding so we're all on the same page. Enteral feeding can also be called artificial feeding. And it involves providing nutrition or hydration via a feeding tube directly into the gut, either instead of or in addition to oral intake. In the UK, enteral feeding is quite common for individuals with neurological conditions who experience swallowing difficulties or those that are unable to maintain adequate nutrition through their oral intake. Enteral feeding can help prevent malnutrition and weight loss, and it may improve the patient's overall well-being and quality of life. So even though I started working with enteral feed in the acute setting, my role for the last 10 years has been in home enteral feeding, which, as the name implies, is where enteral feeding is provided in the community in a patient's home. This might be their own home, a nursing or care home, respite centres, schools or specialist centres. So, for example, we cover in Gloucestershire the Dean Neurological Centre as well. The number of home enteral fed patients in the UK has been rising quite steadily. And with the statutory guidance from the Department of Health and Social Care advising in January 2024 that local areas should agree how to use their resources most effectively to improve discharge planning. And then they focus on developing more home-based, strength-based care. So we can expect the numbers to continue to rise.
So, Michelle, patients with a neurological condition are a cohort you and your team work with frequently. How do you decide on the most appropriate route of feeding?
Firstly, we need to look at the intended use and clinical need for the tube. So this could be established by reviewing the patient's diagnosis, current clinical condition, and realistic life expectancy. So that's quite a lot to look at. So let's break it down a bit further. Is the diagnosis appropriate for having an enteral feeding tube inserted? So for example, NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, recommends that tube feeding should not be used in people living with severe dementia. They suggest that it be tried if the reasons for the person's problems with eating, drinking, or swallowing are treatable, and it's expected that they will be able to start eating and drinking normally afterwards. But studies have shown that nutrition via PEG doesn't prolong survival, it doesn't improve their quality of life, it doesn't make any difference to the dementia patient's weight or nutritional status, doesn't prevent aspiration pneumonia, it doesn't promote the healing of pressure ulcers, it doesn't improve the biochemical parameters that reflect nutrition, and actually, at the end of the day, it might result in complications such as infection, hemorrhage, and gastric ulceration. So in addition to this, the tube insertion process also requires going into hospital, and this might be quite distressing or confusing for the patient. It also might make them less able to do things than they were before that hospital admission. They may not fully recover even after they go home, and on return to their usual place of residence, just having the feeding tube in situ can result in increased distress and confusion, and patients may actually end up hurting themselves or by, for example, pulling on the tube. In dementia, if there are treatable reason for the person's loss of appetite, so where we say things like indigestion, constipation, or a sore mouth, these should be addressed. And then if the person has swallowing difficulties, it may be possible to make food and drink safer for them by changing its texture, so using softer foods or having thicker drinks. Even if the person doesn't want to eat or drink very much or is not able to do so, they can be offered food and drink that they like so that they can enjoy the taste. Moistening the person's lips, if they are able to swallow, offering sips of water or fruit juice can help keep their lips and mouth feel more comfortable. When we look at other neurological conditions, though, such as Parkinson's disease, motor neuron disease, multiple sclerosis, Huntington's disease, etc., these are more appropriate to have interventions such as enteral nutrition support via feeding tube. But the patient's clinical condition at the time may dictate whether the tube insertion procedure is possible or safe to go ahead. Patients with motor neuron disease, for example, may experience a decline in their respiratory function over time, and therefore earlier prophylactic tube insertion may be suggested before the procedure becomes unsafe to perform. We look at their forced vital capacity, or FVC level, to determine the amount of air a person can forcefully exhale from their lungs after a deep breath. PEG is generally considered safer and more comfortable to place when the FVC is at least 50%.
And what happens if the FVC is below 50%?
If the FVC is below 50%, indicating significant respiratory weakness, patients may struggle with lying flat for the procedure, and their sensitivity to sedation might also be affected. In this case, a radiologically induced gastrostomy or radiologically inserted gastrostomy, a RIG, might be considered, which can be performed without sedation and in a sat-up position. Locally, we don't actually offer RIGs, but we work with our colleagues in Oxfordshire who do that for our patients. After deeming that the clinical diagnosis is appropriate for proceeding with feeding tube insertion, we also need to consider what ethical preferences the patient has around enteral tube insertion and artificial feeding. So these preferences need to be discussed with the patient and potentially with their family and carers as well, in order to establish whether insertion of an enteral feeding tube is appropriate, and if so, to obtain informed consent. If we're still planning on proceeding with enteral feeding tube insertion, we want to consider the duration that artificial feeding and hydration support may be required. This links into what nutritional goals we're aiming to achieve and will guide our decision on the most appropriate tube type to insert. In neurological patients, enteral nutrition support is often required long-term, and therefore gastrostomy tubes such as percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomies or PEGs or RIGs, as previously mentioned, are preferred as they are licensed for extended use over 30 days and are generally safer and easier to manage than nasogastric tubes in the community. We then want to look at the patient's feeding preferences and tolerance to their current nutritional intake. If the patient is keen on pursuing a blended diet via their enteral feeding tube, a wider bore or easier to replace, if you will, feeding tube may be the better option. If there's any reason for us to suspect gastric feeding will not be tolerated, such as chronic vomiting, especially alongside very high aspiration risk, we might want to consider that a post-pyloric tube is inserted instead. However, experience shows that post-pyloric feeding is rarely required for this patient group. Lastly, we want to consider the patient's home environment and available support. We need to consider the required care needs for every appropriate feeding tube option and establish if certain options are safer than others, or where a social care review may be required to provide a package of care for tube care or feeding support.
And when it comes to assessing a patient's home environment, how is that done? Is that done through a visit to the patient's home, communication with the family? What do you do if the patient doesn't have family and they live alone?
So we rely on our colleagues in the acute setting as well to information gather a bit prior to discharge. We request that some social information just be provided that we can determine if there might be any barriers we can expect to the patient undertaking their own tube care. If the social situation is reviewed prior to feeding tube insertion, we may decide that an alternative feeding tube is required. Sometimes that doesn't happen, so a feeding tube is inserted, and only prior to discharge do we really get a feel for the patient's home environment. That's where perhaps a package of care review might be required. Ideally, we want to do these. We want to know these things prior to tube insertion because that'll prevent a delay in discharge. Because if you insert a feeding tube and then realize there is no support at home, then you're going to end up with a delayed discharge while a package of care is sorted. So it's a bit of a combination of all of those things. We would, prior to discharge, have the acute team information gather through discussions with the patient, discussions with the family or carers, and we would have discussions between ourselves as well as professionals to see if there's anything that we can foresee as a potential hurdle. And then once the patient's gone home, sometimes we only discover social situations on our first home visit, which is why we aim to keep to the NICE guidelines of doing a first home visit within 14 or 15 working days on discharge. And if we then discover that there are any social concerns, of course, we would be liaising with adult social care, with the patient's consent or family or carers or anybody really to try and see how we can make the situation as easy as possible.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you for expanding on that, Michelle. Would you say there are any factors specific to this patient group when it comes to deciding on the feed type?
Yeah, so there's several factors specific to patients with neurological conditions where we that will determine what feed type we choose. So as with any dietetic intervention, we need to start by considering nutritional requirements. Some neurological conditions result in increased energy expenditure, for example, increased movements in Huntington's or Parkinson's disease. And most neurological conditions result in reduced oral intake from dysphagia. So in these instances, as well as where poor volume tolerance is an issue, high calorie feeds may be our first line options. Other neurological conditions such as PSP or multiple sclerosis may result in weight gain through symptoms such as fatigue, where individuals are struggling to undertake physical activity. Some medications can contribute to weight gain, such as steroids, and which can also cause fluid retention. Stress, anxiety, and depression in relation to the diagnosis can potentially influence eating habits, and that could result in an increase in weight gain. So in this patient group, you may want to opt for lower calorie feeds, but of course provide modular protein and micronutrient supplementation to make up the deficit of those feeds. Setting aside poor volume tolerance, if their general gastric tolerance is quite poor, we need to consider whether a peptide-based feed is most appropriate as a first-line enteral feed. There are certain feed viscosities or osmolarities that may reduce the risk of reflux and vomiting. And in theory, that should therefore reduce the risk of aspiration. But it's important to note that enteral feeding may not prevent aspiration completely. In cases of significant aspiration risk, particularly when patients present with frequent chest infections or in individuals with ongoing poor gastric tolerance, regardless of their aspiration risk, progressing to post-pyloric feeding may need to be considered. When considering your feed type, protein content may also need to be limited or feed timings carefully considered in Parkinson's patients where dopamine precursor medications such as levodopa are used. This is because certain amino acids compete with levodopa for absorption in the brain, and that can potentially reduce their effectiveness. It's recommended that we leave an hour gap before and after administering these medications and your enteral feed. If you find you're really struggling with having enough time available in the day, I'd recommend liaising with your local medicines information team or the patient's neurology consultant to discuss whether these intervals can be reduced between medications and enteral feed.
So when it comes to patients with a neurological condition experiencing constipation or diarrhea as a result of their condition or as a side effect to their medication, what do we need to consider in practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So feeds with added fiber, prebiotics or modified fat content such as MCTs for easier digestion may be helpful. Lower calorie feeds can also be useful where an individual has poor hydration compliance. So alongside their constipation or diarrhea, you'll be promoting fluid intake through prescribing a larger volume of feed. And because that's lower in calories, you'll kind of meet the same requirements that you would have had you gone for a lower volume, higher calorie feed. Mm-hmm. Alternatively, if a higher calorie feed is more appropriate, additional fluid flush protocols may be necessary in those with poor fluid intake. Also to help guide us with our feed type decision, we need to consider the feeding method. Bolus via syringe or gravity may be difficult for those individuals with deteriorating dexterity unless they can be supported by a carer or family member. It can also be challenging in patients who struggle with tolerance to larger volumes at one time, if you will. The pump feeding may make feeding easier for these patients, but we also need to acknowledge it might be restrictive in those more mobile individuals, or it could be unsafe for those individuals experiencing chorea, spasticity, or tremors, which could result in entanglement in or pulling off their feed tubing. Overnight pump feeding may be appropriate if appropriate positioning can be accommodated, the individual isn't needing to get up frequently at night, and they sleep restfully with no risk of entanglement or accidentally pulling out their tubes. Continuous feeding via pump may be the best option in patients prone to agitation or interference with equipment, so that you make that contact less, basically. Mm-hmm. In summary, the feed selection in neurological patients, we have to balance the nutritional adequacy, digestive tolerance, hydration, and practical administration needs, often requiring a tailored patient-specific approach, which may require us to liaise with the multidisciplinary team. What's most important to note is that it's normal to make adaptations to feeding plans over time, and nothing is ever set in stone. So for example, the patient may have required a peptide-based feed during a period of illness, but now their bowels have resumed to normal or their vomiting has stopped, and so a polymeric feed may be appropriate again. There might also be ongoing changes to their nutritional requirements. For example, if there are unexpected weight changes and calorie adjustments will need to be made. Or if your patient was perhaps adamant at the start that bolus feeds were their preferred feeding type, but now that their dexterity is declining, it might be that we opt for pump feeds instead.
Thank you for summarising that, Michelle. So what would you say are the most common challenges faced when caring for this patient group in the community?
Yeah, so this patient cohort faces some common challenges, which kind of across the board with all of our patient cohort, but they also have a few nuanced challenges, which I mentioned in some of the earlier points. So many neurological conditions result in communication barriers, where some individuals are unable to speak on the phone. Others have limited access to digital communication or are too unwell to attend in-person appointments. On the provider side, community teams often face capacity constraints that limit domiciliary support. And then this mismatch can lead to delays in care and prevent timely interventions. Locally, for example, we're funded to manage two dietetic non-home enteral feed neuro clinics a month. The clinic slots are extremely short and the waiting lists long, as I'm sure many of you can relate to. For those individuals unable to attend physically or who are unable to speak over the phone, there is no alternative. And we're also not locally funded to support individuals in care settings such as residential or nursing homes unless they have a feeding tube in situ. Domiciliary visits for neurological conditions are funded in the case of PEG assessment, but again, demand far exceed capacity and funding. So it really varies from kind of area to area, but that's our local setup. As patients with neurological conditions experience deterioration in mobility and dexterity, new challenges also emerge in tube care and equipment management. Progressive motor decline can significantly impact a patient's ability to manage enteral feeding independently. The loss of fine motor skills and coordination can make tasks like handling feeding tubes or equipment, operating feeding pumps, and maintaining hygiene around the stoma site increasingly difficult. This decline not only compromises the effectiveness of nutrition support, but also raises the risks of complications such as tube dislodgement, blockage, and infections.
So, Michelle, where neurological conditions lead to cognitive decline or behavioural barriers, this must then lead to challenges with self-management, compliance, etc.
Yeah, compliance can be extremely challenging, particularly in the absence of a consistent caregiver presence. Patients may forget or be confused by their feeding schedules, fail to recognize signs of complications, mishandle equipment, interfere with their feeding plan, or refuse care altogether. All of this, which necessitates increased caregiver involvement. This added responsibility can place a significant burden on carers who must be adequately trained and supported to manage the complex needs of the patient. Carer burden over time can be profound, especially in the context of progressive illnesses such as motor neuron disease. Caregivers need support not only to ensure quality of care, but also to safeguard their own well-being. Locally, we have a neurology specialist nurse that may pick up on these needs, or we can also signpost carers if we feel that they need to discuss options of respite, specific training, or to make them feel more comfortable with certain tasks. as well as emotional, psychological support. And then as the patient care needs change, with consent, we may also make referrals to social care as required. Providing patients and families with written materials, diagrams, or directing them to trusted websites reinforces verbal explanation. So they've got kind of that written material to fall back onto. Organisations like the MND Association, Parkinson's UK, and the Alzheimer's Society offer emotional and practical support. Recognising that patients and families may need time to process information and ongoing discussions are crucial, and views and decisions may evolve over time. Another challenge often faced is the timing of tube insertion, especially if this falls around the point of deterioration. We know delays in interventions such as feeding tube insertion are an unfortunate reality in the NHS. So it's essential that we find a way to highlight that this patient group is urgent in the context of tube insertion around the point of deterioration. This can be achieved by building a good rapport with frequent liaison with the involved MDT and developing a trust-specific pathway in which we ensure referral for an assessment to discuss enteral feeding tube insertion happens as soon as possible so we can get the ball rolling. This will allow patients with neurodegenerative diseases such as motor neuron disease the time to think about their preferences before reaching the point where their respiratory function is perhaps too poor to go ahead with feeding tube insertion. The pathway should also emphasize considerations around these decisions, incorporate medical, functional, psychological, and social dimensions. It's not just about what's clinically feasible, it's about what's safe, sustainable, and aligned with the patient's goal of care. I mentioned earlier that the interaction between certain medications and enteral feeding can be a challenge, and that's one of the most common challenges in Parkinson's patients. We struggle to find the time in their daily routine to fit in their meals and or enteral feeding alongside the medications. If they're on a DUOPA pump, which provides a carbidopa and levodopa enteral suspension over 16 hours, often overnight, directly into the small bowel, there is limited time available in the day for nutrition to fit in. So we have 8 hours really, but because there's 1 hour after the 16 hours and 1 hour before the 16 hours where we also cannot feed, that reduces it to 6 hours. As mentioned earlier, I definitely recommend liaison with the MDT to establish if medication dose reviews may be required following any enteral feed changes in the future. Within those 8 hours that we have to feed, you also need to consider that the pump is not running when the individual may want to have a wash or take a walk. Fitting everything in can be extremely challenging. Lastly, ethical considerations, particularly around end-of-life care, can feel overwhelming at times. Artificial nutrition and hydration decisions at this stage must be made in close consultation with the wider healthcare team, guided by best interest decisions and informed advanced care planning. Our goal is always to deliver person-centered care that reflects the patient's values and wishes, even as their condition deteriorates. Locally, we developed a guide to support less experienced staff or those facing very complex patient situations with artificial nutrition and hydration withdrawal guidance in home enteral feeding patients in the community. It answers some questions that the patient, family, or professionals themselves may have at the time, like a frequently asked questions section. It guides information gathering to aid decision making, and it encourages MDT liaison as appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Michelle. As you've explained, you know, caring for people with a progressive neurological condition is a complex and an emotive task, as so many parts of the brain can be affected, which, you know, can impact on movement, cognition, speech, understanding, for example. When it comes to communication around food and hydration to patients and their family and carers, how do you then manage that? You know, if you're thinking about the legalities, the resources, MDT team roles, anything like that.
Yeah, so often professionals can mistakenly judge a patient's cognitive function solely based on their neurological diagnosis. But we need to look at the UK's Mental Capacity Act, which provides a framework for decision making when a patient lacks capacity. And it mandates that patients are presumed to have capacity unless proven otherwise. And any decisions made on their behalf must be made in their best interests, involving family carers and professionals. Advanced care planning and advanced decision to refuse treatment are vital tools that allow patients to express their wishes regarding enteral feeding early in their disease progression. These decisions must be respected and clearly documented. Additionally, deprivation of liberty safeguards or DOLS may apply if feeding interventions are used in patients lacking capacity. That's more for acute settings or perhaps in nursing or care settings. As with any medical assessment or intervention, we need to respect and involve the patient in decisions as much as possible, focusing on person-centered communication where we use clear, empathetic, and jargon-free language. For those individuals with speech difficulties, such as in motor neuron disease, alternative communication methods like writing, hand signals or gestures, communication boards or whiteboards, tablets or phones, and even voice banking can be invaluable. Depending on your local services available, speech and language therapy may be able to support in this regard. A patient's changing communication needs can be accommodated through reasonable adjustments. So, for example, by providing email or text communication options where face-to-face contact is not possible, or you may provide more frequent face-to-face opportunities if important discussions are required. Changes to their level of capacity and decision-making needs to be monitored, and thorough documentation around discussions, capacity assessments, detailed record of their advanced care plan and or respect forms kept, including who the patient gives permission to communicate with on their behalf, lasting power of attorney details, decisions made, and the reasoning behind them. So all of that always needs to be clearly recorded. We need to ensure that all team members and carers are aware of the care plan and goals of care promotes consistency and transparency in patient management. Effective enteral feeding management relies on a collaborative approach, and we've mentioned MDT working a few times today. So let's look at who some of the involved professionals might be. We mentioned speech and language therapists, often referred to as SALT, who can support where someone's level of communication is declining. They can also help determine at which stage oral intake might become unsafe and advise on when enteral feeding may be required. Depending on the social situation of the patient and local resources available, community or district nurses may be able to assist with tube care, equipment, and patient or carer training. Neurologists or GPs, along with specialist nursing teams as available, will support with oversight of medical management, prognosis discussions, and referrals to other teams as required. Palliative care teams can support with end-of-life planning and symptom management. And social workers and care coordinators can help arrange support services, respite care, and carer assistance. In summary, effective communication in enteral feeding for neurological conditions is built on legal awareness, clinical expertise, compassion, and coordinated teamwork, all tailored to the evolving needs and wishes of the patient and family.
Thank you, Michelle. Before we start to draw to a close, you are practicing in a split role. Not only are you a specialist home enteral feed dietitian, but you're also a clinical information lead. So this role involves you collating, analysing and interpreting health data relating to the enteral feeding services provided. We really think that listeners would be interested to hear how this role helps to develop your service and the importance of it for developing your service. Could you expand on this for us, please?
Of course. So I can't emphasise enough how much I enjoy this role. It really taps into my geeky side. And albeit super cringe to say, it's not just about managing data, but it's about shaping the future of enteral feeding by bridging clinical practice and data intelligence. So first, the clinical information lead role enables data-driven service development. I'm responsible for collecting, analysing, and interpreting both health and service data. Although the numbers themselves are required to be presented at divisional level, what it really allows us to do is identify where improvements can be made, support in producing reports, drafting business cases, and completing service risk assessments, and thereby directly informing strategic planning and operational decision-making. For example, we're currently working on our demand and capacity modelling to guide a review of our very out-of-date service and funding structure. I've also worked very hard on a, might I say, extremely challenging but fun Excel document that utilises several power queries to pull and compile data on how many unplanned patient queries the team support with every month. It's usually around just over 1,000 unplanned patient queries. And then we also look at how quickly we resolve these queries. Wow. In essence, collecting, analysing and interpreting both health and service data ensures we're able to provide the required evidence that the people responsible for divvying the DOSH, if you will, need to see. By creating performance dashboards and generating meaningful metrics, My role helps clinicians and service leads spot trends and identify opportunities for change. I've been working on advancing several rather basic spreadsheets to be captured in such a way that it's easier for the clinician, capturing data that we record anyway, but in a way that we can actually generate reports off of the spreadsheet, and linking all of the applicable data fields into one dashboard for managerial oversight. Secondly, the role is instrumental in driving quality and efficiency. Through regular audits, clinical governance work, and evaluation systems, my clinical information lead role helps to ensure that the service consistently meets high quality standards and reflects best practice. The post also supports operational efficiency by mapping processes and enhancing IT systems. I provide computer system training to all our new starters, frequently audit use of our clinical forms, collate and review our KPI data, and oversee our team's EPR clinical governance, making sure the team is using its time and resources as effectively and safely as possible. Thirdly, there's a major focus on implementing digital strategies, and this includes steering our team towards the National Allied Health Professions Digital Strategy, as well as the BDA's digital vision. We really need to move into the digital transformation of care era. Over the last couple of years, I've taken control of and increasingly been managing our services patient record system. I lead on liaison with our system provider and local IT with regards to server vulnerabilities, system patches, and system upgrades. I've rewritten and re-imported our clinical forms. I'm continually training staff to use digital tools effectively and building digital confidence across the team, really, which we hope will ultimately improve our data accuracy and patient outcomes. I've also spent time on improving our service visibility, because unfortunately, as I'm sure many of our listeners will agree, dietitians seem to be frequently forgotten by other teams. And I have invested a lot into updating our online presence through our trust's internal and external web pages. This helps other teams know who we are, what we do, acts as a forum for us to promote our team achievements, and thereby we also foster a culture where employees feel acknowledged and proud to be a part of the team. Lastly, and critically, this role enhances clinical governance and safety. It ensures that the service complies with data protection regulations, safeguarding procedures, and professional standards, providing an essential safety net that protects patients and upholds public trust. So why is this role so important to service development? The clinical information lead dietitian acts as a vital connector, bringing together clinical expertise and data-driven insight. This means the home enteral feeding service is able to evolve in line with both national strategy and the unique needs of the local population. It also ensures that the service is guided by robust evidence and audit data, helping teams demonstrate clear outcomes to commissioners and stakeholders. And perhaps most importantly, it supports a model of care that is more resilient, more efficient, and ultimately more focused on the needs of patients and families.
On that note, Michelle, we'd like to thank you for joining us today. This was a great way to explore the various routes of enteral feeding and different feeds from a practical perspective. As mentioned earlier, you can learn more about today's topic in Michelle's article in the June issue of CN. Plus, there is a CNPD quiz linked to the article on our website.
We would also like to once again thank Nutritia Hayward for sponsoring the production of this CN podcast.